Yeah, they got a long time to, well, years actually, to analyze the data. And plus, all the data still isn't in. There's a lot of science data that has to come back that's going to support or, you know, support a lot of these theories that are coming up now. You know, with the pictures now, they need the science reports. Well, we got another year or something of transmissions, I think, probably a little less than that. What was it originally? I think it was 18 or 16 months of transmissions they were going to get back. So, we'll see how they do. By the way, your Voyager 2 was just past the 110 AU, and I know you mentioned 134 on Voyager 1, so they're both out there pretty good. And New Horizon will be not too far behind. That's entering the deep part of the Kuiper Belt now, and we'll be talking about that years from now. But yeah, I think 2030 they're pushing for now. They hope to receive the signals. What happens is the detectors keep getting better. So as long as it keeps transmitting and receiving, they'll keep it up. Every week or so, they make a transmission and send data back. It's constantly sending how many particles it's detecting, either inside the solar system or outside. When it gets more on the outside, less on the inside, they consider it gone outside the physical solar system. Not gravity-wise, but, you know, just dealing with the solar radiation compared to the galactic radiation. I wanted to mention that Edgar Mitchell, a lot of us that are older, pretty much remember the early astronauts that went to the moon, and he was Apollo 14, and he just passed away in Florida, 85 years old, and I think he was sick for some time, but he was a one-time flight astronaut. He went to the moon on Apollo 14 with Alan Shepard and Stuart Rosa. Stuart Rosa stayed in the command module. They were on deck after Apollo 13's failure. Apollo 14 got to go to Balmoral, where Apollo 13 was originally going to go. But everybody's dead on that particular flight. Alan Shepard and Rosa. They're starting to fade fast. A lot of the astronauts wanted to see people return to the moon, in their lifetime. And I think a lot of them still have their fingers crossed. Well, we'll see. Let me drop it. And I was, I thought about the receiving signals that you got back from the Apollo missions that went to the moon. That wasn't 14, that was 15 and probably 16. The follow-up ones, Dick. So, another thing that took place last week is a reboost of the International Space Station with the Progress vehicle. Fired for about 5 minutes, 5.5 minutes. It's attached to the last module on this space station. On the rear end of it, called the ESA Russian module, and it's attached to that. They reboosted they really do this on a regular basis, but they were doing this in particular because they want to be lined up properly for the landing of Kelly and Koryenko. They're coming to the end of their one-year mission next March, March 2nd. So they want to be lined up properly for Kazakhstan, as well as two other launches coming up from Kazakhstan. They have another crewed mission coming up, and behind that, a Progress mission, and they'd like to be, oriented just right so that they could do these four orbit flights. This way it only takes 6 hours or so to get to the space station instead of 2 days like they did in the old days. They still do that now and then if the space station is at the proper location. So, they only went up, 1 kilometer. you. Wow. This is WS2N. Another Soviet launch coming up in April. Although it's another Soyuz launch, there's hundreds or, you know, those things, many hundreds of launches like that over the decades. This is a little different because it's going to be launched from that new launch complex in Vostochny. The thing is, Vostochny is like almost 4,000 miles, you know, to the east. It's on the eastern coast of Russia, a couple hundred miles off the coast, actually. But pretty much desolated. You know, most of Russia's population is toward the west, you know, near Moscow and all. This is way out in the middle of nowhere. It's just been under development for many tens of years. And spent a lot of money, many, many billions of dollars or rubles, whatever they have, and they finally got it to the point where they'll be able to launch a rocket there. But they're building a whole city there, just surrounding this whole place. And it'll be their new launch site for many, many decades to come. They want to get away from Kazakhstan. In reality, it's another country. At one time, it was the USSR, but now it's a different country. And they'd like to launch from their own soil, similar to what we'll be doing. You know, you want to be independent of other countries as much as you can. So this thing's going to be set up for manned flights and everything. Let me drop it. Including the new Angara rockets that the Russians are building that will eventually phase out the Soyuz, which has been around since, you know, the late 1950s. And of course, these are many different iterations of the Soyuz. You know, you've had, you know, 20 different versions of these things over the decades, but still the basic design. Now they're going to switch over to the Angara rocket, which will be able to do light, medium, and heavy lifting. So all in one, you know, depending on how many liquid boosters they attach to it and all. So we'll see how the Russians do. You know what? We also have a new spaceport being built here, but not by the United States. We have Cape Canaveral and Vandenberg Air Force Base, but SpaceX is building a brand new spaceport near Brownsville, Texas. That's presently under construction for them. Drop it. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation of what NASA wants to do with this Clipper, Europa Clipper mission. I've talked about it on that before. It's been planned for many years, and they got the funding recently, a couple of years ago. And what the idea of that mission is to orbit Jupiter, but on every orbit you come very, very close to Europa. So they're calling it the Europa Clipper mission, and that should be launched probably 2020, 2022, or something like that. And they'd like to orbit very close to Europa 44 different times in the process of doing this. They'll be able to get a lot of information. What happened was NASA wound up with a lot more money than they thought they were going to get, you know, in this last budget. And Congress said, well, you got to go ahead for the Europa Clipper. We're mandating you that if you do that, we also want you to include a lander. They're basically telling NASA, you know, you're going to go out there again. When you have a lander, well, the science community loves to have this, but they have no way of doing this properly. They had a plan to launch Europa Clipper on an Atlas V rocket, and by the time it gets out there, after it sheds all its weight, it'll be down to around 5,000 kilograms, you know, roughly 10,000 pounds, going around orbiting Jupiter. Well, the lander, it's twice that weight. It's like 10,000 kilograms to land on Europa. So they don't have enough steam to launch the two together. So now they're saying, well, we need to have two launches, two launches. You know, what's the other choice? The other choice NASA's coming up with, drop it, is the SLS, using the SLS that's being built, Space Launch System. That's the new one that's going to be used for manned launches, eventually to asteroids, cislunar areas, and eventually, theoretically, to Mars. I'm not holding my breath for that, although I'd like to see that someday. But it has the capability of getting there, that's for sure. The choice that they're thinking about with these two missions is launch them both on the new powerful SLS rocket. So, you know, instead of having, you know, all-manned missions in the future, let's use this thing for some robot missions, too. And future plans, they're even thinking about orbiting Uranus. You know, we haven't done that yet. The orbit of Jupiter, Mars, Mercury, Venus, and, of course, Saturn with Cassini. And they'd like to eventually orbit Uranus, which is 20-some-odd moons now. I think it's got 27 moons. But to do that, again, they would use the SLS rocket, which is good. You know, it makes it a multi-purpose rocket instead of just making it for manned missions. I always like both manned missions and robotic missions. Get a lot of science. Robotic missions. And the manned missions, of course, make it interesting. Eventually, people want to go out there anyway. And that's the way you get government support, either here or any of the other countries that are planning all this stuff. A lot of countries have gone on all this science and eventually manned flights. I don't know about North Korea, they just launched a rocket on a polar orbit. The second one that they've ever achieved getting into orbit. Actually, the country's not too crazy about this, North Korea. So, they're looking into what's on it. I did read that they do have a science package on it, but you never know. So that's pretty much it for now, Dick. We'll go back to you for you or anybody else for any questions. This is the space portion of the TechNet. This is WS2N. And I can always be reached at spacenetreport.com. Back to you, Dick.
Nice information, Paul. I've got a couple of comments. In the case of the Europa Clipper, a future spacecraft of NASA that will come by the second of the Galilean moons of Jupiter, Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto. So Europa, I think, is the one with the ice surface, and it might have a liquid interior. Therefore, it has the possibility of life, and to investigate it further sounds very desirable, but there's a problem. To launch something in orbit around the Earth requires a velocity of something like 17,500 miles an hour. If for some reason the Earth was twice as heavy as it is, the exact same diameter, but made out of more dense material, to be in orbit around Earth, you'd have to move a hell of a lot faster so as not to crash into the atmosphere. Because of more mass, it's got more gravity, you need more centrifugal force, you've got to be moving faster. Jupiter is an extremely heavy planet. You can quote me on that. Therefore, when you're in orbit around Jupiter, you are moving fast. Now, you want to discuss, let me drop. I want to discuss getting rid of all that orbital velocity in order to decelerate and come down and land on Europa. That's a tall order. To be in orbit around Jupiter and slow down enough to land on Europa. Doable. But boy, you need a lot of resources to do that, a lot of thrust capability. So I can see how NASA is certainly taking a second look at this. Very desirable to do. I mean, if this is the best of all worlds, we're going to land a spacecraft on Jupiter, we're going to drill down through the ice, we're going to take a sample of the fluid that's down there, and they make all kinds of judgments about life capability. Is it warm enough? Is it in the Goldilocks zone around Jupiter and so on. So, right now, finding life somewhere else in this solar system other than Earth is a very desirable thing to do. Second only to finding life on planets that are Earth-like around other stars, and there's thousands of them that we now know about. mind that hopefully one of those will have the Goldilocks zone and life as we know it. I mean, by way of the Stanley Miller, I can't think of the other guy's name, experiment that was done way back in, I think it was 1950 something or other, they discovered that if you have the right raw materials and you wait long enough, life appears to be spontaneous as we know it. Let me drop it. There's no great magic to waiting long enough with enough reactive materials and finding amino acids that slowly climb the ladder and become living organisms that continuously perfect themselves. So I can see how that clipper, European clipper, is a serious challenge. Now, you mailed me this week, Paul, a beautiful website of NASA showing how they use the RFID in order to identify all the stuff that's coming up in the cargo ships. Let me drop. And that very first picture, I blew it up and studied it. And I'm disappointed. Because I was a consultant for 10 years at a company that was, for a period of time, 2 or 3 years ago, one of the major suppliers of RFID products in the United States. That was simple technology at that time. And many of those antennas, I was involved in the design of those. I was hoping that NASA was using an RFID reader whose physical size and shape I would recognize as one of those products. Unfortunately, it's not. It's some other brand. And because they had to buy it recently, and I can sort of understand how that happened, that division of Symbol became resold for a bunch of complicated reasons. Let's see. They boosted the space station an extra kilometer in altitude. Because the space station is walking that very narrow path, being high enough in altitude that you're not getting a lot of atmospheric drag, but low enough in altitude that you're not hitting the bottom of the higher Van Allen belt, which has got a lot of radiation. So there's a very narrow path that you want to put the International Space Station in. So to boost it another kilometer makes a lot of sense. Let me drop. But you made it sound like to boost it another kilometer makes it line up better for the astronauts coming back down on Soyuz to land at the right spot in Kazakhstan or wherever. And there, I'm questioning that because if you start off a kilometer higher or lower, that's, I think, a minor detail as to how long you do a retro reburn, a retro direction burn, in order to make the Soyuz you're in slow down into the atmosphere and come back down. If I start 1 kilometer higher or lower, it looked to me like that's just a slightly different length of a retro burn in order to put you on the right path. I'm reasonably sure that that recent boost did not change the inclination of orbit. I'm guessing that didn't take place because it takes a huge amount of energy to take anything that's in orbit and change the angle of its orbit, the inclination with reference to the equator. It takes a huge amount of energy to do that. So I'm guessing they're not doing that. Whatever inclination the International Space Station has, I'm guessing it's going to have that inclination, except for some precession characteristics of things in orbit around this ellipsoidal shape Earth, except for some precession characteristics. I think the inclination of orbit of the International Space Station is possibly going to remain unchanged for the history of that program. So I'll pass back to you for any comments on all of the above, Paul. WS2N, our space expert, K2I, WM and TechNet. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, I understand that the times that they like to launch and the times that they like to land, although they can do both at night or day, they do prefer certain time frames, especially in the, well, it's winter in Russia. So they're preferring certain time frames. So that changes, you know, it might change it by an hour or something, whatever it is, one way or the other. That makes sense then.
That makes beautiful sense, and now I see it. The mathematics of being orbit around something, whether it be an orbit around the Earth, whether it be the Earth around the Sun, it follows the so-called three-half law. You take the distance of your orbit and cube it. It is proportional to the period of your orbit squared. So three times distance is proportional to the third power of distance is proportional to the second power of period. So by changing the altitude of the International Space Station, changes the period so that X number of orbits downrange are going to be either earlier or later. So if they went to a higher orbit, and I'm sure it was higher, that means the period is getting longer. That means that when they decide to do the re-entry, they will be arriving at that point later in time because of the extra altitude of orbit. So since they've chosen a date in which they're going to be coming back, and they'd like the sun angle to be at a certain number at the landing spot, I can see how that all works out. It's amazing how you can do these things planning 6 months in the future as to where you're going to be when by determining how much boost you do now. Interesting chunk of science. Now it makes a lot more sense, Paul. Let's see now. We've discussed, I'm disappointed about RFID. I was hoping that was one of my units. With an antenna on the front covered with a Dynaflex injection moldable rubber, but not to be. Some other brand.
Question for Paul when you have time.
You've got the chance.
Let me do the RFID first, John.
Go ahead, Paul.
I know, because I'm going to forget. I always check a couple of different websites. Those pictures I sent, or that website, actually was a NASA blog, but there are other pictures of the same types of things that are, plus a lot more, including a gun, this pistol grip, I'm going to call it a pistol grip, but it drops down in the front, and it's got an antenna on it, and that's up in the space station as well, but unfortunately, it's not a PDF file. I have more trouble trying to mail out a PDF file. Now, I know guys like your son could do it. My daughter could do it, 1, 2, 3. So the next time she's over, I'll send that over to you, Dick. And then you can see one of the guns that they have. I think the one that you saw, it looked like a big tablet-looking thing. It had some depth to it. That the guy was using, but this one actually is a gun type of unit. Maybe that's the one that you have. Different websites are pretty good. There's a, everything I try to come up with, I always go to only two or three websites or a magazine, responsible magazine. I try to do it without. I hate to go to one website. There's a new one now that just came out. Let me drop it.
Yeah, that's starting to sound an attractive, Paul. Each of the RFID readers handheld that I worked on had a pistol grip. Call it a gun. So there's this thing coming out of the bottom of it with a trigger that your index finger goes over, which turns it on and you aim it. So it's starting to sound attractive. So it's a pistol grip RFID reader. There's a chance it's going to be one I was associated with. Back to you, Paul.
I was going to see as soon as I figure out how to just send a PDF file for my tablet. The front end of it, in other words, the picture of a gun and then like a picture of a piece coming down in front of your knuckles, that's the antenna. That's what that looks like. And it's not a new website, but one I just started going to recently. Something called Space Flight Insider. It's really pretty good. Like, there was a launch 2 days ago of an Atlas V. We don't cover all the launches here on the net, but it was one from Cape Canaveral. It was the last GPS of these 30 satellites that they've launched in the last 10, 20 years. And the last of this group, but now here's this launch that nobody else is putting on, and yet this website had it, and he's there in the car with another scientist, actually in the car, looking at the rocket getting ready to take off and giving all kinds of information out about it, and he's pretty good, this guy, Jason Ryan, his name is, and he actually worked for NASA for a while. He started off when he was young, he interned with him, but he's a pretty good, science reporter for this one website. Got a lot of information from this guy. I know John wants to say something, but back to you first.
Take your time on that, Paul, but it would be exciting. exciting to see a picture of that pistol grip gun type. One quick question. The antenna that's on the front cover of this thing that looks like a flat plate that your knuckles come up against, give me a rough guess as to what shape that antenna looked like. Were the outer edges a square, but some other slightly more exotic shape with a little bit of a oval hole in the center of it? What did that antenna on the front end look like, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, it's encased, you know, it's a piece of, like, heavy-duty plastic, you know, almost like an ABS kind of plastic. It's a very strong type of look to it. And there's an arrow pointing that, you know, internally inside this plastic thing is the antenna, so you don't see the antenna.
Okay, so the antenna on the front, it's a flat plate perpendicular to the ground. The knuckles on the pistol grip come up to the back of it. Was it thick, thin, outer dimensions of the antenna, square or some other shape? Try to describe something that you see in the outer package of the antenna on the front end of that RFID interrogator. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, well, if you had, let's say, a magazine and a newsie or something, you're sticking out, not big, you know, that type of design, you know, rectangular in dimension, but I would say it's probably only maybe 3.5 inches long, you know, width maybe, you know, half inch by 3/8, that type of thing. So it's a rectangular type of thing. Directly parallel to the pistol grip that you're holding in your hand. The grip itself there.
Yeah, it's having a little bit disappointing. May not be the shape that I was involved in. Oh well. KC2WGB, go ahead, John. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Maybe it's the takeoff. Maybe they redesigned the thing.
Not likely. You'd be amazed what technology went into that damn antenna. That antenna on the front end of an RFID reader, in order to work well, has to have a reflection coefficient of -25 dB. That's something like a 1.1 maximum standing wave ratio. You don't do that by falling off a log. You got to work real hard to make that happen. Across the frequency range of 902 to 928 megahertz. That's a tall order. There's a whole lot of patents issued on just achieving that. It doesn't happen with computer modeling. It happens, in my opinion, with some very careful tweaking. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. Paul, if you know, last week we were speaking about the spacesuits and the failure with the entrainment of water into the system and things like that. Now, I know that they have to have a PLIS system on there, but we've had that PLIS since they went to the moon and before, and I don't think we had that problem on the journey to the moon and on the moon. So what was different? Have they changed the PLIS or the suit that much? And what do you think the cause of that problem is? Maybe you've read about that. I haven't. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, about, I guess, 4 or 5 days ago, I did read that they're looking into probability of the, you know, you wear this undergarment, you know, you got the spacesuit, but in the undergarment, they have all these tubes running through it. You know, you can push, not refrigerant to it, but, you know, water. And that could be causing a leak somewhere. They thought, you know, Scott Kelly was investigating it. It's up on a space station still. And they thought they saw a leak coming out. And then they moved it around and it stopped. And they tried to get it to leak again, pressurize it again, and it didn't leak. So they said they're still going to work on it. They got some time. But next time SpaceX comes up, you know, that's the one that actually could return science equipment, and in this case the spacesuit, back to NASA. They'll take a look at it, and they'll send another one up. So whether they're just going to send
send the, you know, on the garment back to them, or they're going to send the whole EMU back. I don't know. We'll see. I don't think it has anything to do with, like, you know, the, they've got a safety unit that's, you know, propelling them all around. But, you know, above that, they have air conditioning, heating, communications, batteries. And that's all part of the suit. But, somehow they've got these tubes piped into the internet, the whole setup, which circulates the all the cooling fluids through, but it's on the garment. Quite a setup.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Rex recently did an ABA, and they didn't have any problems. Although the one guy was getting kind of cold, and they put a couple of calls up to him. You know, you bet, you know, you want to go back in? He's, no, I'm all right, I'm all right. And you know, he's done like, you know, four or five EBAs over the years. So, you know, I think he knows what he can get away with. And his partner, too, he was just as experienced as he was. And not to say all guys weren't. This happened to Tim Copra. He's the American. And done EBAs before. His partner was from England. That was his first EBA, but he's not the one that had a problem. He assisted by wrapping everything up, and that was Tim Peake from England. Back to you, John.
I'm going to add a couple of words on this one, John. When you're in true weightlessness, like an EVA outside of the International Space Station, any water that's floating free in your breathable air is possible of getting into your nose and into your lungs and creating a lot of grief. When you're on the moon, the local lunar gravity makes all the water settle down at the bottom of the spacesuit somewhere. It's not floating free in space and not going to drown you. So when you've got local gravity or local acceleration, you can probably tolerate a hell of a lot of free-floating water inside your suit. But when you're in true weightlessness, an extremely small amount of water that happens to flash in front of your face, so to speak, and you can't move your body just right to control where it goes, and that can drown you. I mean, your lungs really don't like breathing water. An extremely small amount of water on a healthy subject that gets into your esophagus will trigger a foreign object reflex where your esophagus closes down and you're not breathing anymore. And you can become awful unhappy in a hurry. KC2WGB, KQIW.
Yeah, but it's like they had the EVAs outside the spacecraft, the deep space walks that they did have on the Apollo mission.
Yeah, well, as long as they're in true weightlessness and microgravity, you got to really worry about this problem. Over to you, John.
Yes, I can understand that on the moon, but like Paul said, they did some EVAs. All right, but I didn't hear any reports about, like, when they came in from the moonwalk and they were disrobing, there was no moisture reported or anything like that that would indicate there was a problem. But then those suits were new, and who knows. The other thing, Paul, is they've had this problem a couple of times. Do they know if it's the exact same undergarment that caused the problem or that was used and they could pin it down to one particular item, or is it multiple units that are given the problem? If you know. Back to you, Paul.
And the one guy was Lewis, I forget what that P, I forgot his name, but he's from the European Space Agency. And he was the one that had a dangerous situation with the water. And doing the EVA on, you know, on the American side, left the Quest lab. And he was out there for, you know, an hour or so. And then he said he's got water in the helmet. He kind of like feeled his way back to get back to the Quest lab. He, you know, they just told him to keep reaching one hand in front of you, and I told him where, you know, where the handrails were. He was in tough shape, and they said it was see, they can tell which kind of water it is by tasting it now. You know, it floats in front of their nose, and they can taste it, and they can tell you, well, it's probably from the cooling lines, you know, from the undergarments, or there's a lot of moisture that builds up in the space and they're supposed to have filters that suck this out of the, you know, the air. You know, you have air flowing, and it's supposed to be located like right behind the helmet somewhere. And if the filter gets clogged, you're going to wind up with all this extra moisture just from sweating. And it has happened before on one of the earlier Gemini missions. To Eugene Cernan, who eventually went to the moon on Apollo. He was the last guy to walk on the moon. But Eugene Cernan, during the Gemini mission, he went outside and he just couldn't get back in. He had all kinds of things planned. He was going to put a backpack on, and he got nothing done. All he did was got himself all excited and couldn't control anything. They didn't have proper handrails anywhere. And they say he loaded up with water. He couldn't see. He was totally fogged over. He finally got back inside, and they said, in his boots, in his feet, when they finally took the suits, they took the suits off and they brought it back to Earth. They had like over 2 pounds of water floating around in his feet, the suits, when they took it out of the spacecraft. But they said he lost. They think he lost about 4 or 5 pounds floating around. He was so tired, so exhausted. Back to you, John.
Okay. See, I wasn't aware of that they had previous problems. All right. Well, thanks for those answers. Interesting stuff. I'd like to know when they get that suit down here. The forensics are going to be amazing. Maybe we'll get an exact condition of what happened. Back to you, Dick. KC2 WGB.
Space is dangerous. You can quote me on that. I mean, there are a number of high school students today dreaming about the time when they will see astronauts walking the surface of Mars. They'd like to go there. They think it's going to be a great frontier adventure. They're willing to go and sign up for a one-way trip to go there forever and never come home. And living in a spacesuit, on paper it sounds nice. You actually go through all the mechanisms of installing that spacesuit, installing that life support system, establishing all of those pieces of tubing for heating, cooling, airflow, air conditioning, carbon dioxide absorption. There's a zillion things that can go wrong in that spacesuit. And an astronaut with that spacesuit is literally wearing a diaper, because waste disposal is a huge problem. And so if you are living day in and day out on the surface of Mars, you want to go out of your abode, let me drop it. And you think you just slip on the spacesuit and then go walking around Mars. You look at the movie called The Martian, and many of those details were glossed over and they made it look real simple. No way. So, spacesuit is a dangerous object. Running at very low air pressure, it's running on, I think, pure oxygen. It's got one hell of a reliable power supply, running all that equipment in your backpack. And that backpack is trying to do the best it can to, inside of the environment of that spacesuit, try to simulate essentially all the conditions of temperature, humidity, air, oxygen, whatever, of planet Earth. No easy task. So, spacesuits are dangerous. That's the way I look at it. What do you think, Paul? The first two N, KQRIW.
Oh, the whole thing is dangerous. Lift off the landing. They take their life in their hand every time they go out. You know, look at the space shuttle system. We actually lost 2 shuttles, 2 out of 5. can't have that. The record is not good enough. So they got a long way to go to make everything on the safe side. They're a long way from safe. I was going to say something about the getting to Mars. Oh, okay. I'd like to see the beam module that's going to be going up probably end of March, I guess, maybe April. SpaceX is going to bring it up to the space station. The beam is the one that's the expandable module. It's the example of Bigelow, etc. available. I forget what the A is for. But it's going to be attached to the space station, and it'll be 13 feet diameter and 10 feet deep. You know, very small, but it will be inflated. It'll increase in size like two or three times its size when they blow it up. But if it works, they plan on using a lot bigger modules. I mean, huge modules. You know, this thing's got 500 square feet. We drop it. Talking about modules that will be many, many thousands of square, I think square meters. I think there's a 330. That's 330 square meter module. And they plan on putting these things in space and creating space stations out of it, and eventually landing them on the moon, blowing them up on the moon. And you have big modules there. Send them to Mars. And now you have plenty of living room anyway, you know, on Mars. You know, you have a lot more living room than you had with the Martian movie. But it all depends on whether or not this thing's going to work out that Bigelow is sending up. It's proven technology. He has already launched one's called Genesis 1, Genesis 2. They're still in orbit. They're still inflated, you know. And this was back in 2007. He couldn't get an American launch at the time, so bought a ticket on a Proton Russian rocket, two of them. And they're still up there floating around taking pictures, still operating. Back to you, Dick.
To establish an inflatable module as a living quarters on the moon of Mars seems simple. That's just the beginning of a solution of living there. Normal human being breathes 10,000 liters of air per day. That's 10 cubic meters of air. Each cubic meter of air has a mass of 2.7 pounds. So 27 pounds of air goes through your lungs every day. Somebody's got to supply all of that consumable on the spacecraft. 10,000 liters of air per day under normal conditions you're going to breathe. So bringing up the raw materials just to allow you to breathe, not even worrying about do you have enough water, enough food, enough energy to create enough heat to create a desirable environment so you don't freeze to death on Mars. Just the air alone requirement represents a lot of technology as I see it. You see where I'm going on that one, Paul? Ain't easy. 2S2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, I know. In the beginning, it will be very difficult, but eventually they'll have the same system that they have on the ISS. You know, they don't bring up all the oxygen. I mean, they do, but a lot of it's recycled. They have all kinds of scrubbers going on to knock out the CO2. Now they got the Sabatier unit, invented by Sabatier, and that's probably separating the carbon dioxide that we exhale, sending that oxygen back into the system. So between that, hopefully finding water on the moon, they know there's ice, therefore water on Mars, no problem there. Not only that, they can get the oxygen out of the Martian atmosphere. They have carbon dioxide on the all over the planet, mostly carbon dioxide. Just have big Sabatier units and separate to get rid of the carbon, and they'll have plenty of oxygen. So I mean, that's the long term plan. But in the beginning, it'll be like the limb, the longest limb stayed was three nights, Apollo 17. And I don't know how much longer they could have gone if there was an emergency, but, that was all self-contained. K2RIWWS2N.
Question, Dick?
Go ahead, John.
I'd like to hear your opinion on inflatables on Mars. I know the air density is different, but at 300-mile-an-hour winds, that might be an issue. What do you think? KC2WGB.
How much wind resistance and wind pressure you get is a function of velocity squared and density linear, I think. Because Mars has a atmospheric density that's something like 0.7% of what we've got on planet Earth. It's, I think, less than 1% Earth air pressure. So even though you get 200 and some odd mile an hour winds, the total amount of pressure you get out of that might not be so great. But the question I've got for you, Paul, is in the case of the Apollo and Mercury and other missions, the spacecraft contained lithium hydroxide filters that took the carbon dioxide that was breathed out by the astronauts. Let me drop. If I understand correctly, those filters simply captured the carbon dioxide to remove it from the breathable air. You could go on breathing the right ratio of oxygen and nitrogen and so on to keep your body happy. And when it comes to recycling, on the International Space Station, are they able to take the carbon dioxide, lots of it, that all those human beings are breathing out 24/7, are they able to operate on that carbon dioxide exhale and reprocess that into oxygen and carbon? Are they able to get the oxygen back out of that? Just to filter it and have it locked up in a filter only partially solves the problem. If the oxygen breathed out by the astronauts could be recycled, then that would drastically decrease the amount of cargo you've got to deliver. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, for years it was like that, you know. For instance, the lower shuttles came up with plenty of oxygen tanks, you know, constantly resupplying it. And they, you know, they still do it. Last Cygnus spacecraft came up with four foot long, maybe 2 foot diameter tanks, and they had the equivalent of 6,000 psi in there of oxygen, and they brought them into the space station. And the shuttles used to do that on a regular basis, but you know that right now is just to make up what they can't recycle. They are recycling a lot of the oxygen, and one of the ways to get rid of the carbon dioxide is through Sabatier. Some French guy that invented this thing back in the turn of the last century, I think. But he's not allowed to use it on a regular basis. And it has broken down a lot since quite less. I don't know how many years since I've been up there, probably since at least 2009, I would think. I think that's when they bought up Tranquility. Tranquility was the last node that they bought up. There's three nodes. There's the Unity node, there's the Harmony node, and then they bought up the Tranquility node. Big, gigantic modules, you know. And they interconnect everything over the other modules. And on board Tranquility is, well, one of the good things they bought up was another bathroom, so they don't have just one bathroom anymore. Now three. And then other thing in Tranquility is the Saboteur unit, and that is primary job is to, you know, separate out the carbon dioxide, just like you said there. Broke down quite a bit. In the last couple of years, I haven't heard any problems, so I think it's doing pretty good lately. Back to you. Question.
Go ahead, Joe.
Are they using the same type of air recycling system that's been used on U.S. submarines for years and years and years?
I don't know, Joe, but I would say that's if they're recycling the oxygen on board the submarines, I guess they are. They stay down on the nuclear ones for years at a time. Unless, what are they doing on the submarines? Are they taking the, do they have a desalinization thing where they're bringing in the water, salt water, and then now you've got water, and you could use electrolysis because you've got nuclear power. Got all the power you want, and they say to separate the hydrogen and oxygen, and they can breathe all the oxygen they need. I would think that would be the system that they would use, but I don't know. I'm not familiar with the submarine show. Back to that.
possible, Joe, that electrolysis of seawater to derive oxygen could be a lot less energy intensive and equipment intensive compared to taking carbon dioxide and converting it back into carbon and oxygen. The B2RYY for any comment, KTRIW.
Well, I don't have a comment because I don't know what they're using a U.S. submarine to be able to, you know, provide breathable oxygen because the submarines stay down for, say, I don't know, 6 months at a time. I think the only thing they have to come up for is food. But they can stay submerged for at least 6 months at a time, so they got to be getting the oxygen from someplace. You think this comes from seawater directly?
Joe, now I'm going to be looking this up. I was hoping you were going to have the answer. You know what? I'm going to be reading about next week. Back to you, Dick.
As usual, we have more questions than answers. Supplying the oxygen at the right pressure and the right constant, the right combination of oxygen, nitrogen, and whatever. Difficult problem. 10,000 liters per day flows through your lungs. Something like 2,000 kilocalories per day flows through your body in the form of oxygen, water, and food. 1,000 calories per day. Your body is continuously generating 130 watts, 450 BTU per hour, just of heat. With all that metabolism going on in your body, just before you start doing heavy exercise, you're generating 130 watts. All of that energy has to come from somewhere. So in a submarine, in a spacecraft, on Mars, supplying all of that raw materials to keep that body happy, not easy. And to go to Mars and think you're going to go there in this frontier. Let me drop it. You and your 3, 6, 9, 12 friends are going to have enough raw materials to sustain life for years at a time on this one-way mission. On paper, it sounds good. My belief that the people in the sound of our voices are not going to see that happen in our lifetime. Not even the lifetime of my children. That's my belief. The sheer cost. Going to Mars versus going to the moon could easily be 1,000 times more expensive. The lunar program of Apollo is something like $33 billion in 1970 money. That's probably equivalent to $150 billion today to go to the moon. Something like 1,000 times more expensive to go to Mars. That's going to take the funding of multiple nations to do it. And each of those nations are going to say, if I give you 10% of my gross national product to support this mission, what do I get in return other than some beautiful pictures of people walking around and living on Mars? This extremely desolate desert 300 million miles away. I don't see it happening. Each of our high school students are dreaming about the day they will see an astronaut or their friends walking on Mars. Got a feeling as to how likely this is, Paul? Keep your finger on the pulse of what NASA is doing. I mean, it keeps the public interest up to discussing this. But can it even be possibly slim, real? WS2N, K2RAW.
I'm guessing the best they could do is 30-35. But they're going to need... NASA even came out with some kind of a report. I think it was over 30 SLS launches. Each SLS launch, by the way, is equivalent to a Saturn V launch or bigger. And they're thinking about, because of the funding, roughly one launch a year. So that gives you an idea. I mean, they need infrastructure. You need habitat modules up there to dock with, to eventually go to Mars with. You know, you're not going to go up this little capsule with four people. You know, I mean, they know what the habitat modules are going to look like. I mean, I've seen it for 300-day uses and 560-day, I think it is, uses, and you know, the different sizes of the these habitats. It looks like you're taking pieces of the space station and hooking them together and then putting a big rocket behind it. It's going to take a lot of launches. We've got Elon Musk. He originally thought he could do it. And he still has plans for it. You know what? I think he's Russia's got a better shot at doing it than NASA does. Drop it. You know, if he puts his mind to it, he's self-funded, so he might have a shot to do it. Look, he's come a long way since 2002. Look what he's doing now. So, I don't know. I keep an eye on him. I know he'll probably, I wouldn't be surprised if he's the first one to land an unmanned Dragon spacecraft on Mars and have a, you know, a rover type of setup where he could pick up some material, put it on board a self-contained rocket that he's going to have on board the Dragon, and shoot it back into space, meet up with another rocket, and go back to Earth. I think he's got more of a possibility of doing that than NASA. But even that has got to be, I don't know, a lot of years away. I'd like to see a moon colony built. I mean, when you get to Mars, like you said, what are you going to do? I mean, if you're going to set up a permanent colony where, you know, there's going to be thousands of people living there, yes, but we're a long way off from that. What they should do is go back to the moon and have a series of different moon bases. And at worst, if nothing is gained from going to the moon, you know there's a Hilton type of people that will put hotels up there. And, you know, you would have people who have nothing better to do with their money sit in a rocket ship and fly up to one of the hotels that are on the moon. At least, I mean, tourism would pay for it, you know. In the beginning would be, you know, all these billionaires going up. But eventually the price would come down.
Lunar Trump.
Why they gave up that idea years ago, I'll never know. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, it sounds like fun, John. It takes something like $20,000 to launch a pound of material into low Earth orbit. Maybe 10,000, but numbers like that. To go from low Earth orbit to landing on the moon, maybe it's another 10 to 1 increase for each pound. So, the sheer dollars required just to boost a human being to the right velocities, to aim him at the moon, to have him go through that Van Allen belt at a time when the sun is not erupting with some huge amount of coronal mass ejection that issues an amount of radiation that can damage the daylights out of our satellites, and who knows what it would do to human beings at that time. Again, it sounds nice to have hotels on the moon and rich people going there. But the sheer dollars involved, yes, it's exciting. Let me drop.
Falcon 9 is going to drop the price, Dick.
What's the price going to go down to for getting to the lunar surface by Falcon 9? Each pound that you send there, give me a rough guess to how many dollars involved to do that with Falcon 9 of a new UFO.
Yeah, right now the Falcon 9 is just like any other rocket. Actually, they're on the less expensive side for launching their rockets. But, you know, you're right about the $10,000. But because he's going to have these things reusable, and he looks like he's not too far from making that a reality, he could get it down 100-fold. So instead of, you know, a $10,000 flight per pound, like you said, that's roughly what it is, you know, to do any kind of orbital flights, he can get it down to $100 a pound. So, once that happens, things will change, and then the competition is going to set in, or already all the other companies are thinking about it. In fact, Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos owns that company. He launched New Shepard up back in November, 2 months later, took the exact same rocket, launched it back to the common line. All right, it's not in orbit, but it's suborbital. Got it into space, separated a capsule from it, and brought that back again. It's twice with the same spacecraft, so they're working on it.
Okay. I'm in favor of